Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. I want to show that people need not be limited by physical handicaps as long as they are not disabled in spirit. That's what Professor Stephen Hawking said a couple of years ago after experiencing weightlessness on a specially equipped airplane. The world's most famous physicist had ALS. He was certainly not disabled in spirit, though, and he possessed an almost unbelievably powerful mind. Hawking died this morning in Cambridge, England, at the age of 76. From a brief history of time, through his revelations that black holes are not entirely black, Stephen Hawking inspired generations of scientists and explorers to transcend the limits of body and of this planet to make a journey of the mind to the farthest reaches of the universe. This hour on Point, we'll remember Stephen Hawking. You can join us on air or online. Were you inspired by Stephen Hawking? How did he transform your understanding of the universe? And how can science encourage more like him, more thinkers like Hawking, who somehow managed to be on the cutting edge of their disciplines and capture the public imagination? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, we'll begin today in Cambridge, England, with Professor Harvey Rial. He's a professor of theoretical physics at Cambridge University. He was a student of Hawking's and then worked with him on the faculty at Cambridge for more than a decade. Professor Rial, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to meet you down the line. I'm so sorry it has to happen on this day as we remember Professor Hawking's passing. But before we start, I just want to play one little piece of tape hearing from the professor himself. This is an interview that was included in a 1993 collection of essays called Black Holes and Baby Universes. And Stephen Hawking was reflecting on his life and the fact that he had developed ALS.
The prospect of an early death made me realize life was really worth living. There is so much one can do, so much that anyone can do. I have a real feeling of achievement that I have made a modest but significant contribution to human knowledge despite my condition.
That's Stephen Hawking in 1993, and of course because of his ALS he had to speak through a computer assisted, his voice was computer assisted. Professor Rial, I have to say it makes me quite emotional to hear that piece of tape because I'm one of the many millions of lay people who was so wildly inspired to wonder about the universe through Stephen Hawking, and to hear him describe that he hopes he had made a modest but significant contribution to human knowledge, it really moves me. I mean, what has science lost in his passing?
Well, science has lost, first and foremost, one of the great scientists of his generation. Stephen was a truly outstanding theoretical physicist. He made many amazing contributions to the subject. But we've also lost a very successful popularizer of science. He's brought through his books, films, and TV programs science to millions of people around the world. We've also lost an inspirational figure, someone whose courage in overcoming this horrible, debilitating illness was an inspiration to many people.
Yeah. Now, you were a student of his first and then worked with him as a fellow faculty member. I mean, as a student of Stephen Hawking's, what was that like?
That was a wonderful time. So I was Stephen's student between 1997 and 2000. I think looking back on that time, I find most impressive is the amount of time he gave to his students. So he was very generous with his time. So towards the end of my PhD, we were spending maybe 3 hours a day chatting about physics, doing calculations together. It was a wonderful time together. We shared quite a lot of jokes. That was always one of the pleasures of working with Stephen. He had a great sense of humor, and I think one of my favorite memories of him is what his face and how it would break into an enormous grin when he was telling a joke, often at my expense. But So, yeah, his sense of humor was wonderful. His optimism, his sense of optimism, which I think was great, and must have helped him cope with his disability.
Yeah,
it was a wonderful time to be there with him.
And then as a colleague, as a fellow faculty member, mm-hmm. I mean, is at that tier of cosmology and astrophysics, it's a relatively small community, I imagine, worldwide. I mean, were you all constantly sort of watching what Stephen Hawking was doing, where his mind might take theories next? I mean, was it more competitive or trying to do a game of catch up?
Well, clearly Stephen was seen as one of the very top people in the field. So whenever he said anything, people would take it very seriously. So he was famous for making bets on major issues in physics. And whenever he won or lost a bet, that was always a cause of some curiosity and interest in the wider public, especially if he did it in a very public way at a large conference. So, yeah, his pronouncements were always viewed very carefully, and people studied his words and took what he had to say very seriously.
Yeah. You know, I'm seeing here that Neil deGrasse Tyson, the famous American scientist and physicist, tweeted today that his passing has left an intellectual vacuum in his wake, but it's not empty. Think of it as a kind of vacuum energy permeating the fabric of space-time that defies measure. It's a pretty good remembrance.
That's very nice, yes.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk with you for a moment, if I can, Professor Riel, about just about the science, the transformative science that Stephen Hawking really brought to us in the 60s and 70s around black holes, and sort of what that tells us about the origins of the universe, or might tell us. So let's hear a little bit of Hawking himself. This is from a 2016 BBC video, and he's explaining how black holes work and the electromagnetic radiation emanating from black holes that now bears his name.
Quantum mechanics implies that the whole of space is filled with pairs of virtual particles and antiparticles that are constantly materializing in pairs, and then coming together again and annihilating each other. One member of a pair of virtual particles may fall into the hole, leaving the other member without a partner with which to annihilate. The forsaken particle or antiparticle may fall into the black hole after its partner, but it may also escape to infinity, where it appears to be radiation emitted by the black hole.
That's Stephen Hawking in 2016 describing what's known as Hawking radiation. So this enormous amount of energy that he discovered black holes spew back into the universe, how important was that discovery?
Well, that is really the major discovery of Stephen Hawking's career, and that has transformed our understanding of black holes and gravitational physics. So this was the first attempt to combine.
Professor Riel, are you still there? Looks like we may have lost that line with him. We'll pick that up again. We'll call him up again in Cambridge, England. We're talking about the death of scientist Stephen Hawking. He died early this morning in Cambridge, England, at the age of 76. So let's turn now to Kitty Ferguson. She joins us from Bluffton, South Carolina. She's author of Stephen Hawking, An Unfettered Mind. And Stephen Hawking frequently introduced her to the public as his biographer. Kitty Ferguson, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meg. It's nice to be here.
Thank you for joining us today again. I'm sorry, though, it has to be around Professor Hawking's passing. So, I mean, you were hearing Professor Harvey Riel there describe sort of the central, most famous discovery that Stephen Hawking made about Hawking radiation and all that energy that black holes spew out to space. I wonder if you could just pick up a little bit where he left off. Why was that discovery such a big deal?
It was one of the first discoveries. I think what he was about to say was that it combined cosmology or the theory of relativity even with the quantum theory in a way that hadn't been done before. Now, that needs some explanation, but my memory of that, reading that in A Brief History of Time, and my memory is my daughter at that time was 8 years old and trying to do a science project, and we pretended we were those particles, mm-hmm. one of which fell into the black hole and one of which didn't. And that was shortly after I first met Stephen Hawking, I think in 1989. So, yes, it was a very important discovery. And I think everyone considers that his greatest contribution. And in his greatest scientific contribution. I think his contribution went way beyond science.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I've always been so impressed with him is not only does he want to convey his science to the general public, to the, what he calls the ordinary people, but he wants to convey the fun of it. Mm-hmm. You know, he really does. He wants to say, this is fun. This is an adventure. And that's what he's been able to get across in his books and his television, especially, you know, the shows, documentaries and things. That's just been tremendous. And no, I don't think there's anybody else that has quite succeeded in doing that to that extent. Even when you couldn't understand what he was saying, you were caught by his enthusiasm and his joy in it.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks like... Oh, I'm sorry, Kitty, I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but I just wanted folks to know that it looks like we have Professor Harvey Real from Cambridge, England, back with us. Professor, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. Sorry about that. Some sort of interference down the line there, but I'm glad we got you back here. We've got just a minute before the break, and I wanted to return to sort of the core science here just for a second. I mean, as far as I understand, again, from a layperson's perspective here, the reason why Hawking radiation was such an important discovery is because it was sort of a meeting of classical physics and quantum physics around black holes?
That's exactly right, yes. Yes, it was the first major discovery which combined aspects of general relativity and aspects of quantum theory and led to a compelling picture of how black holes are actually thermodynamic objects. So it was a unification in some sense of gravitation and thermodynamics, the study of hot objects.
Yeah, and as Kitty Ferguson was saying just a moment ago, even with a mind as abstracted and powerful as that, he also managed to communicate with all the rest of us who may have not understood the elegance of the mathematics behind his theories. So we'll talk more about that when we come back. I'm joined today by Professor Harvey Real. He's a professor of theoretical physics at Cambridge University, and by Kitty Ferguson, author of Stephen Hawking, An Unfettered Mind. We're talking about Professor Stephen Hawking. He died this morning in Cambridge, England at the age of 76. How did he affect your life and your understanding of the universe? And Professor Real, I understand I have to let you go, so thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the life and legacy of Professor Stephen Hawking. He died this morning in Cambridge, England, at the age of 76. And, you know, maybe there's some randomness in the universe that occasionally throws out some beautiful coincidences, because today is March 14th, 3.14, Pi Day. It also happens to be Albert Einstein's birthday. Stephen Hawking was born on January 8th, 1942, the 300th anniversary of the death of Galileo, so a certain continuity there of great minds through time. I'm joined today by Kitty Ferguson. She's author of Stephen Hawking, An Unfettered Mind. And before the break, Kitty was telling us about how, for most of us who may not have understood the mathematics behind Hawking's theories, it was the example of his life that really reached people, and the fact that he was so able to cross borders and barriers and become part of pop culture itself. And here's an example, because Stephen Hawking did appear in a 1999 episode of The Simpsons, where he shared a beer with Homer at Moe's Tavern.
Your theory of a donut-shaped universe is intriguing, Homer. I may have to steal it.
Wow, I can't believe someone I never heard of is hanging out with a guy like me.
All right, it's closing time. Who's paying the tab?
I am.
I didn't say that.
Yes, I did. Dope.
That's Stephen Hawking in a 1999 episode of The Simpsons. Kitty Ferguson, pick up on that. I mean, how important was it to Professor Hawking that he had these other avenues to reach people?
I think he absolutely loved that. His appearance on Star Trek, The Simpsons, and Dumb and Dumber, all these things. He loved doing that, and he also, you know, I don't know, that really turned him on. He loved it.
Yeah, well, so you mentioned Star Trek. We actually have a clip from that episode. It's a 1993 episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, and the character of Commander Data, the android, always played wonderfully by the actor Brett Spiner. Data organizes a holographic poker game to see how three of history's greatest minds would interact with each other, Stephen Hawking, Albert Einstein, and Isaac Newton.
It's your bet.
I raise 50.
Blast. I fold.
I fold as well.
The uncertainty principle will not help you now, Stephen. All the quantum fluctuations in the universe will not change the cards in your hand. I call.
You are bluffing.
And you will lose.
Wrong again, Albert.
That's Stephen Hawking from a 93 episode of Star Trek The Next Generation. Kitty Ferguson, we need to talk in some detail about the fact that Stephen Hawking was able to accomplish so much and over so many decades despite having ALS. Now, he was diagnosed, what, in 1963 or so?
Well, I believe that's right. I don't know that I have the date exactly right. But
1963,
his semester,
yes.
His first semester as a graduate student at Cambridge University. And, you know, it was devastating. And when I first wrote about him, I wrote a book about him in, was 1980, I think it came out in 91. And I tried to write about all that in my own words and finally decided I had better just quote him. He'd given me a lot of material that he had written earlier about his disease and his feelings about it and his reaction to it, just to quote him. And those are the quotations that I've used ever since, and in my books and in my lectures. And it's always so much more moving to hear it in his voice and how brave it sounds. Mm-hmm. And he always says, it's not brave, I just, what else could I do? I just had to cope, you know, but it sounds terribly brave. And I think that part of his impact on my own life has been to cause me, first of all, to love science, but also to be less afraid of illness for my family and for myself. Because it's just a lesson that it doesn't have to be, the sun doesn't have to shine every day and everything be perfect for a person to accomplish so much and to enjoy their life. You know, that's a huge contribution. And also, I have to say to my shame, before I knew him, before I encountered him, I thought of sort of disabled people as another world, you know, another not me. And then you meet him and suddenly you realize, oh my gosh, you know, you miss so much if you don't mm-hmm. communicate and make a connection with people that aren't me, you know. So,
yeah, you know, in the case of Professor Hawking, I mean, what was remarkable, and he acknowledged this, is that he was diagnosed in 1963, just 21 years old.
Yes.
At that time, given just a couple of years to live, but almost miraculously, the progression of his disease somewhat stabilized. And at that, I believe not that long thereafter, he's quoted as having said, when you are faced with the possibility of an early death, it makes you realize that life is worth living and that there are a lot of things to do. I have it because you mentioned the brave things that you said. I have another piece of tape here. If you just allow me to play it, because I want to hear your response to it. This is a 2011 interview with the New York Times, and he told the Times that despite having ALS, or also known as Lou Gehrig's disease, he always tried to lead a full life and still had many things that he wanted to accomplish.
Obviously, because of my disability, I need assistance. But I have always tried to overcome the limitations of my condition and lead as full a life as possible. I have traveled the world from the Antarctic to zero gravity. Perhaps one day I will go into space.
Kitty Ferguson, how do you respond to that?
I am saddened that he never got to go into space. He wanted so much to do that, and I kind of thought he would, you know, but that he didn't. Mm. So, but he did. He really wanted to do that, and he's been thinking about that and planning that and hoping for that and for a long time. And that didn't happen.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I read that in part because of him having ALS and him losing control or the ability to use his hands, that prevented him from working through on pen and paper a lot of the complex mathematical equations that he needed to to sort of flesh out his theories. So instead, you know, he did that all within the confines of his mind and was using different techniques unique to him, more sort of geometric techniques and theoretical techniques. So, I mean, is it a stretch to say that his ALS may have sort of taken him in a different direction, but that ended up being a positive influence on his science?
Well, he has said that, theoretical physics was probably one of the very few things he could have gone into that he could do all in his mind, didn't need his hands. He's had help from his students through the years and his colleagues doing some of the long, when you go to a physics class or a conference, the equations fill lines of the blackboard, or the whatever they're writing on up in front of the class, just fill it. And I know that there have been people who said, well, he could do all that in his head like Mozart could compose a symphony in his head. I think to a certain extent he could, but he also depended on other people,
right.
And he did, and would not have denied that himself.
Yeah. Well, we have so many people who want to share their thoughts about Stephen Hawking, so let's turn to them. Linda is calling from Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin. You're on the air, Linda.
Hi, Megha. I met him at the 1989 Courage Award at the Courage Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I was a graduate student, communicative disorders, so we were studying people who had, needed to use technology to communicate. And to meet him, I was like, my knees were weak. I was just thinking. And he looked at me, he kind of glanced over, and with his device said, who's more scared, you or me? Just said, me.
Wow, Linda. And so, I mean, like, how did it feel? I'm just wondering, why was it that you were so nervous?
I had studied about him, and then we were told he was going to be there. And I'm a speech language pathologist, so I always tell my kids, I met Stephen Hawking, and my kids, they study physics, they've had science in class, I've told my colleagues, I actually met the guy, and it's like, that's my claim to fame. I met the guy, I think about it now, and it's amazing, as someone who works with people who have ALS, and I work with children and adults who need assistive technology, the fact that he's lived this long, he's in the Guinness Book of World Records.
Right.
For living.
For surviving with the disease, exactly. Linda, thank you so much for your call. We just got a lot of other people who want to share their thoughts, too. So let me turn to Michael, who's calling from Tampa, Florida. You're on the air, Michael.
Hi, I just wanted to comment that it's really fascinating that he has become such a large part of popular culture. Specifically, I like watching the TV show Big Bang Theory, and it's always neat. When he's injected into the show.
Yeah, well, you know what? Like magic, the amazing producers of On Point actually have a clip from The Big Bang Theory. It's from 2012, and Stephen Hawking appeared on the show in an episode where Sheldon Cooper, played by Jim Parsons, wrote a paper about particle physics that impressed Hawking.
Your thesis that the Higgs boson is a black hole, accelerating backwards through time, is fascinating.
Well, thank you. It came to me one morning in the shower.
That's nice. Too bad it's wrong.
That's Stephen Hawking in a 2012 episode of The Big Bang Theory. Kitty Ferguson, one quick question before I bring in another guest here. We've heard Hawking multiple times this hour speaking through the computer-aided, his voice, computer-aided voice. I've read that the only thing that irked him about it was that it had an American accent because it was programmed and designed in the United States.
That's true. He didn't. He would have preferred to have a British accent, but later on he was given the choice of changing it and decided that his own voice, the American voice, had just become so associated with him that he wouldn't make the change.
I think it actually led a lot of people to think for a long time he was an American, which of course not.
Yes, I think so. And that voice has been used other places. It's used to be on the ticket machine at the Savannah Airport.
Wow. Well, Kitty, stand by because I want to bring in another person in this conversation. Vijay Balasubramaniam. He's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania in the physics department. He's a biophysicist who met Stephen Hawking on multiple occasions, and he joins us from Philadelphia. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
Hi, Professor Subramaniam. Balasubramaniam. So first of all, tell me, what are your thoughts today on the passing, on the death of Stephen Hawking?
oh, you know, it's sad because he was such an inspiration to people all around the world. And I remember reading A Brief History of Time and reading about Hawking already when I was very young. And I remember reading about the evaporation of black holes, things like this, way before I could actually understand these things, before I had even studied physics. And it was always, you know, deeply inspirational. And also to overcome the physical handicap that he did to make all these scientific achievements. It's just really extraordinary.
Mm. And so how have you seen, I mean, I don't know how much your actual area of work, your body of work overlaps with the work that, that Hawking did. Is there a lot of overlap?
Well, actually, you know, I was trained as a string theorist, as a, working in the quantum theory of gravity.
I see.
And actually, that's partly my main job. I also do biophysics. But I came to know Stephen personally because he offered me a job at Cambridge many years ago. And I didn't go. And after that, we kept in touch, and he kept inviting me to events and conferences. So I came to know him. And it was always a really moving experience. I listened to what the other lady who called and said about their knees going weak. And I think that happens to graduate students who meet Hawking for the first time, too. You know, he's a monumental figure intellectually. And I think the thing that impressed me most when I used to meet him at Cambridge was the sheer will. So even when he was sick with, you know, a cold or a flu, in addition to having ALS, he was at work every morning at 9, and he would work all day and then go home. And, you know, the typical graduate student, you know, you don't feel well, you kind of go hide in bed until you get better. And it was just an incredible willpower that he had. And it was a real inspiration, I think. So in addition to his scientific brilliance, I think at a personal level, the willpower was what I admired. And my own thesis, my PhD thesis, was squarely based on trying to resolve the paradoxes about quantum mechanics that Hawking's work on Hawking radiation implied.
Wow. Professor Balasubramanian, one quick question, because you mentioned string theory earlier and that how that's sort of at the heart of a lot of your work. I'm just looking at the New York Times here saying that string theory, which claims to finally explain both gravity and other forces and particles of nature as tiny microscopically vibrating strings, is currently the leading candidate for a theory of everything. Is that something that Professor Hawking believed as well?
I think he did, at least later in his career. There have been various alternative approaches that people have proposed, but the most viable candidate at present is string theory. And he interacted extensively with many string theorists and adopted many of the ideas from string theory into his own thinking. And of course, string theorists were heavily influenced by the many ideas that Stephen produced about the nature of gravity, the nature of time and space. And so since string theorists want to unify quantum mechanics with gravity, you know, there was a wonderful synergy, I think, in the two directions.
Oh, sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there, but I wanted to turn back to Kitty Ferguson for just a minute because, you know, it got me thinking, like, we even in just this conversation, we're bouncing back and forth between, like, this high abstracted theoretical physics and the very real impact that Stephen Hawking had on the lives of so many people. It just reminded me that in A Brief History of Time, didn't Professor Hawking write that if indeed we do discover a unified theory of the universe eventually, that it should be made comprehensible to all? So that all of us can take part in the grand discussion about why the universe exists.
Yes, he did say that, and I think he liked to think that he could. I have an interesting anecdote actually. When I was helping him write, I was helping him with his book "Universe in a Nutshell" that he wrote. I was called on to help him make it simpler. And we would sit there in his office in Cambridge and have the manuscript of his book on one computer screen and his, and of course he uses the other one in order to communicate. And I would point, I'd say, Stephen, now that sentence, that little part there, that's too difficult. You've got to make that simpler.
But, Kitty Ferguson, then, stand by for just a second. We've got to take a break. I really want to hear the end of this story, but we're going to get back to it when we come back from a break. We are talking about the life and legacy of Professor Stephen Hawking, the world's most famous scientist. He died this morning in Cambridge, England. We'll head into the break with Keep Talking by Pink Floyd. The song includes samples of Hawking's voice. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
For millions of years, mankind lived just like the animals. Then something happened, which unleashed the power of our imagination. We weren't in the talk.
There's a silence surrounding me. I can't seem to think straight. I sit in the corner, and no one can bother me.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about the life and legacy of Stephen Hawking, the most famous or publicly recognizable scientist of the past 50 years. Died this morning in Cambridge, England. He was 76 years old. And just as a measure of how much he truly was beloved by people around the world, but especially those in his field, here's astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. In July, he told Larry King that Stephen Hawking is a brilliant scientist who committed his lifetime and effort to making science relatable. And deGrasse Tyson also said he believes Hawking is deserving of a Nobel Prize.
If he doesn't get one, I'd be disappointed. But I think? I think he's transcended the Nobel Prize. Same with Einstein. If you talk about Einstein, he did this, the relativity. You don't then say, did you know he won a Nobel Prize? That's like anticlimactic compared to what he actually accomplished at that level. So he might transcend all awards he could possibly be given.
Well, I'm joined today by Vijay Balasubramaniam. He's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania in the physics department. And also by Kitty Ferguson, author of Stephen Hawking, An Unfettered Mind. And Kitty, I'm sorry I had to interrupt you before the break there, but you were telling us a wonderful story about a time when you were writing a book with Professor Hawking.
No, there are just so many wonderful stories to tell. But I wasn't writing a book with him. This was his book called Universe in a Nutshell. And I was called on to help him make it simpler. And so, as I was saying, we had the two computer screens in front of us in his office, the communication screen that Stephen uses to communicate, you know, to talk, and the other one with his manuscript of his book, as far as he'd gotten with it. And I would point out a certain paragraph or a sentence, and I'd say, Stephen, that's too difficult. We've got to find a way to put that in simpler words. And then he, because it takes him a little time to answer with his machine, and the answer would come, it seems perfectly clear to me. And I thought, oh, my gosh, we're in trouble. Then I looked over at him with this big grin. I could tell he was having me on. But what was really impressive about that was how hard he worked then to bring that down with help from me, more like I was acting like the guinea pig. Could I understand it? Did I think other people would understand it? To try to make it simple. That meant a lot to him to get it across to other people. That was a very important mission of his life, you know? And so that was a wonderful experience. There are just so many stories to tell.
Well, on that point, let's go back to our callers, because I think they're really responding to this. Jim is calling from Omaha, Nebraska. You're on the air, Jim.
Hi, Meghna. My favorite quote from Stephen Hawking is, our greatest success comes from talking, and our greatest failures come from not talking. And I think that's so true, whether you have a disability or you're talking to your kids or you're talking to Russia or North Korea.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for that thought and thank you for your call. Professor Balasubramaniam, how do you respond to Jim there? I mean, because I think one of the things that Stephen Hawking did so well is he showed that when scientists, by virtue of their disciplines and the fields that they work in, when they choose to do, as Jim said, talk more, talk to the public, become more public-facing, they're able to actually start conversations and get us to think in ways that maybe, you know, we don't have, that we don't do enough in the regular public discourse.
I absolutely agree. So I think, you know, part of the role of any scholar is to convey the fruits of knowledge to the broader public, because in fact the broader public cares and is interested. So, you know, I've had the experience of being in cabs all around the world. And the cab driver, when he finds out that I'm a physicist, will turn around and start asking me questions about, quantum mechanics or about cosmology or something. And Stephen was really was passionate about conveying these ideas. Now, I have to say that if you read The Brief History of Time, it's not always necessarily fully comprehensible to the lay public. You know, I gave that book as a present to my parents, and their comment was, it's really beautiful, but we didn't really understand it. But sometimes that doesn't matter. You know, sometimes you read poetry and you don't really understand it, but it's beautiful and inspiring anyway.
Well, and but to the point that Kitty was making, that it was really, really important for to Hawking to make things as comprehensible as he could. He came back and wrote a briefer history of time, right?
Right.
And took out a lot of the technical details.
Right. And you know, partly through that role, by doing that, you know, I think part of the reason he's so beloved is he became a sort of metaphor for the human condition. You know, we're all, tied hand and foot by being sort of animals on the earth. You have to eat, you've got to find housing, there's the daily life, but and you get sick, you die, but we all yearn for deeper and higher truths.
Right.
Now, Stephen Hawking was even more challenged than physically than most of us, but he really exemplified the idea that there are these higher truths and that you should try to learn them and then try to communicate them.
Right.
So I think he was deeply influential that way.
You absolutely hit the nail on the head. That's kind of where my mind was this morning when I had heard that he had died, because, I mean, I just feel like his influence, I'll tell you, on me personally, really had less to do with the science that he was grappling with and more to do exactly with what you're talking about, that with a determination, you can achieve things beyond your wildest dreams. It's sort of a testament to the human spirit. I'm going to monopolize this conversation. I want to get other people here to a chance to have their say. So let me turn to Bob, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. You're on the air, Bob.
Hi, Meghna. You're the best. I just wanted to make the comment. We are what we are, and we do what we do because of so many other people. I remember seeing the movie The Theory of Everything.
Mm-hmm.
It was about his first wife, Jane Wild Hawking, who cared for him and encouraged him. He never would have been where he was or anything or able to communicate if it wasn't for that person, if it wasn't for the persons who developed the machine that he was able to communicate with, all those students who helped him. Just wanted to make that comment.
Yeah. Bob, thank you so much for doing that. And actually, since you did mention The Theory of Everything, this is the 2014 movie about Stephen Hawking's life. Hawking was played by Eddie Redmayne. He won the Oscar for his portrayal of the professor. We've got a cut here from the movie. Here's Eddie Redmayne in a scene with Felicity Jones, who plays Hawking's first wife, Jane.
If Einstein is right, if general relativity is correct, then universe is expanding, yes?
Yes.
Okay, so if you reverse time, then the universe is getting smaller.
All right.
So, what if I reverse the process all the way back to see what happened at the beginning of time itself?
At the beginning of time itself?
Yes. So the universe getting smaller and smaller, getting denser and denser, hotter and hotter.
You mean wind back the clock?
Exactly, wind back the clock.
That's Eddie Redmayne playing Stephen Hawking in 2014. Felicity Jones playing Hawking's first wife, Jane. Kitty Ferguson, you were actually making this point a little bit earlier about the enormous amount of support that Stephen Hawking received throughout his whole life. Tell us more about Jane, his first wife.
Well, I think she was a remarkable woman. First of all, it took courage to marry him in the first place because their whole courtship and everything, as was shown in that film, took place at the time when he was just beginning to cope with that illness, not even knowing where it was going to go, how long he was going to live, if they got married, whether that marriage would just be like a year before he died. And he said himself he could not have done what he did without Jane, and I think that's very clear. And he depended on her all those years, probably put more of a burden on her than he should have. But, yes, I mean, she's absolutely essential.
Mm. But then they got divorced.
Yes, they did. And when I first wrote my first book about him, I took it over for him to look at before it was published, and nobody had told me that they were breaking up. And then I learned it when I was in Cambridge and had to change the book because it had been a celebration of their life together, their achievement together, and all of a sudden it became a somewhat darker story, you know. It was a really challenging experience for me because that's part of the story too, the difficulties that his fame and his actual willpower made for his family.
Mm-hmm.
And that I think that is I think that comes out in the movie A Brief History of Time. No, I'm sorry, Theory of Everything. Maybe that it's a little more of a feel-good movie than the whole thing was. It was a darker, grittier story, but it's a beautiful movie.
Well, let's take another call here. John is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. You're on the air, John.
Hi, Meghna. I have a bit of a horse in the race I'm about to present, but you're talking about science and truth and in light of Stephen Hawking. And it seems to me that since the Bush administration in this country, and maybe a little before, science has been under fire, with religion, an alternative idea being felt by many to replace science, and that disturbs me. And now in the Trump administration, truth is under fire. So I would love to hear your guests comment if they know anything about Stephen Hawking's views, or perhaps their own in light of his passing, on science and truth and where we are going.
John, thank you so much for your call. Professor Balasubramaniam, you want to take that?
Sure. So, you know, I think scientists play a role similar to the role that monks used to play in an earlier era. We are, to some degree, custodians of the quest for truth. Stephen certainly saw himself that way, as most scientists do. And Stephen was not, per se, a religious man. He wasn't dismissive either of people's different ways of trying to understand the universe and to give themselves comfort, but he certainly believed, as I think everyone should, in the importance of, you know, rational, fact-based analysis of the world, right? The world knows its facts, and we should know them too. Pretending that the world isn't the way it is just a bad bet to make. So certainly Stephen felt very strongly that way. And for example, on issues like climate change, he clearly felt that humans were the biggest threat to their own existence.
Right. In September of 2016, he joined more than 300 other scientists and wrote an open letter to then candidate Donald Trump about the threat of climate change, and really wanted the United States and really criticized Trump's call. And then he later followed through on the U.S. leaving the Paris Climate Accord.
Now, absolutely. Now, just to illustrate this, I can illustrate this also with his approach to science. So, for example, you know, every kid on the planet has wondered, can you go back in time? Right, you know, go back in time, kill your grandfather. You know, there's the movie series The Flash on TV, for example, that's all about going back in time and so on. So Stephen, when he thought about going back in time, he said, well, let me try to actually analyze the facts about what the general theory of relativity says about this. And he proved that you couldn't go back in time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. It was a fact-based analysis about the nature of physics and the nature of matter and energy, as opposed to sitting around and thinking wishfully about the way things should go. And I think his approach to life in general was like that. And like him, I think most scientists would say you should approach the world as a whole in that scientific spirit. It's just a better way to be, because you're more likely to be, you know, successful in the world.
Kitty Ferguson, we're down to the last several minutes of the program here. You know, I take a step back here for a moment, because it's entirely understandable that in the first flush of reaction to when someone as famous as Stephen Hawking dies, that we focus on sort of the positive and influential aspects of the person. But you knew him so well and for so many years. I'm just wondering, you know, did he ever talk to you about the things that he found that of his challenges, or when he struggled, his failures? I mean, I don't want to paint him in a superhuman light, because he was very much a man.
Yes, he was. And, we shouldn't end on a negative note. you know, he has a reputation for being, he does have a very strong will, did have a very strong will, and that didn't go down well with everyone. He always treated me so well, so that anything I would know that was negative about him came by hearsay from other people. And you do, you know, hear a lot, but he was terribly nice to me and kind to me and helpful to me in everything I did. And even times when he might have been angry with me, like when my first book was supposed to be, that he helped me write, was supposed to be for young adults and then was published in the adult market and became a bestseller, he could have been livid about that because he had said he didn't want anybody to write a biography about him. But he wasn't. He understood perfectly what had happened. He did publish things himself. He knew what that world was like. He was just lovely about it. And I was so scared. I even took my little girl in with me to talk with him that day because I knew he loved children and wouldn't get angry in front of her. Mm-hmm. You know, he was just an awfully nice man and fun to be with. I never, to tell you the truth, every time I went in to talk with him, I took in a list of questions, mainly to do with what I was writing about him. But at the end of the list would be questions I really wanted to know myself, the deeper, more personal questions maybe. Well, it's very slow communicating with him.
Yeah.
He never got down to those questions, and I am sorry about that. Mm. I wish that had happened.
Yeah.
But well, I don't know. We don't have any time here. There's one other anecdote I wanted to mention. But I think we don't have time, do we?
if you could get it in 30 seconds, you think?
Well, it's a comment that his colleague Gary Gibbons made about him last summer at a conference. Gary was a graduate student with him at Cambridge way back when, and Gary came to Cambridge thinking he was a brilliant physicist. He says, I thought I was a brilliant physicist, and I met Stephen Hawking, and it was like Salieri meeting Mozart.
What a beautiful analogy. Vijay Balasubramaniam, we have just a minute to go here. Your last thought, and how do we encourage more scientists to sort of push in the directions that Hawking went?
He was human, like all other humans, and had his pluses and minuses. He was also a lonely man sometimes towards the later years of his life because it was very slow talking to him. Mm-hmm. So my sense was not as many people talked to him as should have, could have, would have, because it was just hard to do so. But I think the thing that we can do to remember him in the positive light and what we can learn from him is courage, right? He had courage. And that is the way in which if people have courage, they can do like him and achieve similar greatness, yeah. I would say.
Well, as Hawking himself once said, he believes he was lucky in his condition that had ALS had progressed more slowly than is often the case. It shows that one need not lose hope. Vijay Balasubramaniam, professor of physics at the University of Pennsylvania, thank you so very much for joining us today.
You're most welcome. Thanks for having me.
It's a true pleasure to speak with you. And Kitty Ferguson, author of Stephen Hawking, An Unfettered Mind, thank you for your time and your reflections about a truly great scientist. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much. Is Professor Subramanian still there? I'd love a word with you.
We'll try and connect you guys a little bit later. I got to wrap up now. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Thanks for listening. This is On Point.